Hey everyone, it's Alan Schimmel for Tech Strong Gang. We've got a great day. We've got what's going on with Intel. Same old, new stuff. Is AI really sustainable? Are LLMs commodities? We've got that and more, as well as a special guest on Tech Strong Gang. Hey everyone, welcome back here. Happy Thursday to you. We've got a great Tech Strong Gang today. We've got three blocks we want to discuss. One is regarding a lot of information coming out on Intel. Some of it's good, some of it's bad. We've got a very special guest who's going to bring the intelligence on Intel to you today. We also have a great block on sustainable AI, sustainable by design, with our own Echo Insights editor, Bonnie Schneider. And then we're going to talk about, in maybe the fastest instance of internet time, have LLMs already become commodities? We're going to discuss that more. Let's kick it over to our chief content officer, Mike Rizzard, who'll jump in on this.
Hey guys, always happy to be here. We're going to talk to Daniel about this next topic right away, but Intel's got a $7 billion operating loss in its chip making unit. They're reorganizing the company. They got $8.5 billion from the government to go build some factories somewhere, so maybe they're $1.5 billion ahead here, I don't know. But Daniel, what's going on with Intel? I know you follow them closely.
Hey, wait, but before we do that, Mike, not everyone here knows Daniel.
Well, really? I thought you introduced
him. No, I just said we had a special Intel intelligence guest. But this gentleman right here, Daniel Newman. Daniel is the CEO founder of Futurum. If you're not familiar with Futurum, it's futurumgroup.com is the website, isn't it?
Yes, sir.
Daniel, welcome to Tech Strong Gang, man. It's a pleasure to have you on here.
Yeah, it's great to be here. A number of the analysts of the Futurum Group have joined Tech Strong over the years and over some different events, and it's fun to be in the studio with you all. Intel, first of all, chip making. The chip industry is cool again. I just want to point that out. There was a period of time where it was all about cyber, DevOps, and AI. Well, thanks to what happened a few years ago, the shortages, people couldn't get vehicles, they couldn't get laptops, they couldn't get their phones. All of a sudden, chip making became the most important thing in the world. And I think you mentioned, Mike, when you talked, you said $8.5 billion of grants. They also got $11 billion of loans. They're building a super fab in Ohio that hopefully will bring the U.S. back on parity, at least back to some level of parity, in terms of what Taiwan is able to do. We don't make any leading edge chips here. We make none. And that's a really important detail here for everybody out there in the audience, is that Intel has this kind of bifurcated role. First of all, they are a really important company in the United States. Gina Raimondo, the Commerce Secretary, came out and said basically they are a treasure. But here's why it's important is AI, and we're gonna talk about AI probably all the time on this show, right? Y'all talk about it quite a bit. Well, you can't run any of these software, you can't do any of these developer apps, you can't, you know, build security applications without chips. In fact, silicon will eat the world. I made that prediction 3 or 4 years ago, okay? I'm running amok here. But the point about Intel is, yes, they reconfigured, they resegmented their business yesterday. So you talked about a $7 billion operating loss. What we were talking about there is they've now split to a products and a foundry model. So everybody thinks about these fabless companies like AMD and NVIDIA, great business models, make a ton of money. Well, Intel is actually a fully integrated design manufacturer of chips. They make the whole thing from, they design them, they manufacture them, they sell them. They were presenting their business as an integrated model, and the market wasn't fully understanding it, because now they're coming out and saying, hey, we're a foundry. We're a foundry as well. So if they're going to be a foundry, that means they're going to make chips for Qualcomm. They're going to make chips for NVIDIA. They're going to make chips for AMD. By the way, they're going to make potentially chips on ARM, not just x86, which everyone knows them for. So yesterday they came out and said, basically, our foundry business, it's not making any money. But we went back and we're actually going to show you what our business would look like if we were running a fabless and we were running a foundry. Their foundry is losing a lot of money. The fabless part of their business, though, is actually making a lot of money. So Pat Gelsinger and their CFO, David Zisner, came out and basically said, we're going to show everybody how this works. Now, why this is really important in the end is, one, Intel as a fabless does very well, makes a lot of money. Two, they've executed what they call their 5 nodes in 4 years. And this was a really important thing, because the company needed to get back in some shape of design leadership, their technology leadership. Mm-hmm. And let's face it, they fell behind. NVIDIA obviously jumped way ahead in AI. They're so still AMD. Way ahead. AMD across x86 took market share, both in the data center and on PC. And now we basically need to understand is, can Pat Gelsinger right the ship? What he wants people to understand is he has helped right the ship. But the foundry business, let's face it, if the US and the West cannot manufacture leading edge, 5 nanometer, 3 nanometer, 2, 18 angstrom future nodes, we will fall behind on a global scale. And that yesterday is important. But my last thought, I'm not gonna talk a lot, I'm sorry. My last thought is basically, when does this foundry become profitable? We're gonna invest $8 billion in grants, or $8.5 billion in grants, $11 billion in loans. They're building all these fabs. Everybody, it's gonna take 3 or 4 years just to get to a return on invested capital. It could be
before. You think it'll be that soon? I thought it was gonna take 3 or 4 years.
2030 is when they're really talking about being able to start. Well, I'm just talking about the whole foundry business. Okay. Yes, those foundries themselves, they definitely take time to recoup cash. They came out, they were very honest about it. They were forthright. Investors probably didn't love it, but now they've done this great reset. Mm-hmm. And we now know what Intel's plans are and how they look as both a foundry and as a fabless.
I'm a little more cynical, and always am. So,
really,
Pat Gelsinger, is he not now the new modern Lee Iacocca and Chrysler, and this is a bailout from the United States government courtesy of the taxpayer, which is okay, but let's just say what it is.
Well, they're not the only company getting grant money. So, you know, every one of these fabless and design companies, whether it's Global Foundries, whether it's Intel, they're all looking to get capital. So are companies like NVIDIA, AMD, Qualcomm. They're all looking because there's innovation dollars, there's mm-hmm. foundry and development dollars. Look, when the government's handing out dollars to push innovation, every company's gonna be looking to participate. Having said that, the reason Intel is so important, Mike, and by the way, I can be cynical about this too. the reason it's so important though is that we don't have another option. We cannot completely outsource and offshore all of our leading edge development. And right now, the only companies that are developing and building fabs in the US are not US-based companies. So mm-hmm. you have TSMC building in the US, you have Samsung building in the US. And these are good partners, these are good allies, but at some point you have to understand geopolitical situations change. And if the US was ever required to be self-dependent, to be able to make its own leading edge chips so we can have these phones and these laptops on and next generation vehicles and cars. You know, the lagging stuff we do okay. You know, mm-hmm. no one likes when I call it lagging, by the way, Alan. But the leading stuff, like, we want to win AI. And by the way, China, I don't care whether they get EUV, whether ASML is shipping to them or not. This is a little technical stuff, but
I understand it.
China will not stop because of the controls that we're putting into place. They're figuring out their own ways. You saw iPhones down 33% last month. That's because they backed Huawei. They're pushing Xiaomi, Harmony, and they're making it easier and more desirable for people to buy Chinese-made products. And yes, their economy has its own challenges as well.
No, but yes, it does have their own challenges, but the iPhone market in China was like Apple's, I want to say second or third largest market.
Second, I believe.
And it's tanking because the Chinese are very good, the government there is saying, hey, buy the Huawei one, buy the local one. But I want to be clear, to take in your cynicism and your point. When we talk about $8 billion and $11 billion, some people say, yeah, but they're building factories, it's going to create all these jobs. Well, no, a lot of these foundries and stuff and fabs, it's all robotic. It's not a heck of a lot of jobs. But to your point, it is a strategic initiative based on this country's need of high, you know, cutting edge chips. We can't afford that if there's a war in the Taiwan Straits, that we don't have chips.
Or an earthquake.
Or an earthquake is yesterday, right? Or the day before. So it's important. Here's my cynicism, though. I commend the loyalty to Intel. They're a national treasure. They've been a national treasure for as long as I've been in technology, 30-something years. Are we putting too much money into an older horse here? And is there some other ones that, you know, are we kind of funding innovation by doing it primarily with Intel, or should we be spreading those dollars around to some new growth?
Yeah, well, they put about $53 billion into this with almost five times that in terms of loans and other investments in innovation. No one else has raised their hands. There's no other company that's willing to build because it's hard. It's really, really hard. I mean, TSMC has built a very, very robust, very important business on a global scale, but there's no other company that's saying we're willing to take on the manufacturing, the building the plants, hiring the people, and building these leading edge chips. And the expertise is complicated. You know, what we've seen over the years has been a lot of distribution of capabilities. You got these EDAs, companies like Cadence and Synopsys with IP ARM, mm-hmm. that have made companies like NVIDIA able to develop, build, and offshore their chip making in a very streamlined way. They don't necessarily have the foundry expertise. So someone has to take that on. Having said that too, I kind of find these, like I actually put a tweet out this week. I said, we're going to need a CHIPS Act too. $8 billion is nothing. We're adding $1 trillion to the deficit every 90 days in the United States. $8 billion on investment in the most important foundational technological advancements that are going to happen in the world over the next couple of years. I'm not joking. Like in the next two decades, AI will rule the economy. The companies that are able to participate and play will be the winners. So it's not just about Intel. It's about, can Microsoft continue to succeed? Can Google continue? They need the silicon to do it. And by the way, they need a partner to manufacture because they're not all going to run it on NVIDIA. And that's a whole other topic for another day. But Google's making chips. Microsoft's making chips. Amazon's making chips. And by the way, they're going to be able to do it because of foundry. They need capacity. They need to not be 100% dependent on having it done in Taiwan. Just the microaggressions and geopolitical tensions between China and Taiwan is enough of a reason that the U.S. has to get this right. $50 billion is nothing. And I hate to say that because I'd take $1 billion of it and I could make a good life of it.
Probably,
but yeah. We need to spend a heck of a lot more if we're actually going to win this.
It's strategic.
Will this play out as we hope, or is it going to be a situation where we're telling everybody to buy made in America, quote unquote, but then they're still going to buy stuff that's ARM-based, made elsewhere, so... What's the back end of this thing?
They could build ARM right in these. So what we're really seeing here is the decoupling. This is an Apple play. Remember, you open your iPhone, it says designed in California. It's not built in California. They're right. Built over there. This is the decoupling of the chip business. Intel will still design killer chips. But they're going to become a contract manufacturer. You want to build an ARM? I got it for you. You want to build a new GPU? For AI, we'll build it for you. They're going to become a contract manufacturer.
Lots of places to build those chips around the world.
We need to build them here.
Yeah, I think the point is there's going to be some distribution here. We're at zero right now on these advanced chips.
We need this.
You know, Pat's been reasonable. Of course, he would love to see us get to 50-50. But I mean, look, being at 90-10 would be an incredible
progress. That's a 10x improvement.
and we need to have some level of self-dependence here. And if you're not worried about that, we literally do not have a single industry that can function without silicon.
Do you think that there's more awareness about this? You mentioned because we just went through the pandemic and we saw how dependent we were on China.
Couldn't
face masks. Or then we were like, what about Advil, Tylenol, things, everything that we depend on.
Supply chain.
So how do they balance what Intel needs to do and the time allotted while they're not making money doing, you know, presenting profits with the need to be independent? That seems like it's going to be a tough balance in the years ahead.
Yeah, that's a great question. First of all, the company is very profitable on its the fabulous part, now the way they're calling it products. Mm-hmm. They make a lot of money on products. They've carved out all that expense from the manufacturing side now, and they're putting reasonable arm's length business relationships. So they're charging reasonable wafer, you know, costs back to the products business, but they're treating it more like if NVIDIA was buying from TSMC, now that's how products is buying from Foundry. So you can see how that actually works. So they make the money here, but over here, again, they're getting the grants, they're getting the loans. They have Smart Capital, which is another way they've raised, and I think it's somewhere around $50 billion of total access that they've been able to get. There's no option to not get this right. Now, in the end, I will actually say, I've gone on the record and I said, there is a better outcome. Now, it's not a good outcome. I'm going to be very clear about this. If Intel products fail, if the foundry succeeds. I know it's crazy as that sounds, but in this current era with the EDAs, with the ARM and the IP companies, you know, there are a lot that can now design chips. We can design CPUs. You know, you got ARM, you got RISC,
absolutely.
You got different ways to make phones, you got different ways to make laptops, you got different ways to make cars, you know, the silicon for cars. But we cannot get the foundry thing wrong because, like I said, we're one... you know, tactical missile away from having no access to leading edge chips. And, you know, we sometimes say that in jest, like, oh, well, if China, you know, look, China believes it has a right to Taiwan. It believes this. And no matter what we say, if at some point they decide that they want to no longer play nice, which we could argue whether they do today or not, it would put us in a situation we should never allow ourselves to be in. So this has to get, this has to happen, this has to be done right.
No, this is too strategic. I don't disagree at all. I want to give a shout out. I have a friend of mine down in Houston, my friend Misha Goldstein. Misha was the founder of Alert Logic, but he left there. He founded another company called, I think it's MacroFab. 5 years ago, he told me this. He said, Alan, we're going to a world where we need to build our chips either in, I think he was doing stuff in Mexico and the US. Yeah. And we're just going to be a contract manufacturer for chips. And I laughed at him back then. I didn't, you know, I said, how are you going to compete with Intel? How are you going to compete with AMD? See, there's going to be a lot of people who want chip designs. And he was dead on. So if you're watching this, Misha, good on you, man. Anyway, I think that's going to wrap up block one here on Tech Strong Gang. We're going to be back. I think we've got Mitchell Ashley waiting in the wings, and we're going to talk about sustainability and AI, something near and dear to Bonnie. We're Tech Strong Gang. We'll be right back.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the Tech Strong Gang. Well, we are talking about sustainability because in the wake of the high demand for everything AI, sustainability has to come into the conversation. And recently, Microsoft has been addressing that, especially with their ambitious goals of reducing carbon emissions by 2030. If you want to build lots of AI products and you want it at the same time, you have to address it. So some of the Microsoft points that were brought up were water usage. Maybe we should be using air rather than water for cooling, perhaps turning to sustainable materials. There's a lot of different solutions that can be done as we see the momentum build for AI when it comes to sustainability. So I think this is going to be a growing part of the conversation as most companies are looking to reach these goals by 2030. You know, it's sort of like wanting to have your cake and eat it too. You have to do it in a sustainable way in order for it to last and to not tap into the resources of the earth. As everyone's doing this at the same time, clearly there'll be an impact.
Yeah, I think this particular blog article was almost like a position paper saying, here's what we think, this is what we're going to do and how we might do it. And there are also kind of secondary and tertiary uses of the byproducts of what, like, for example, air, like the heat coming out of a data center, also using that to heat homes. I think it's like one data center could heat 6,000 homes. So they're thinking, they're sharing ideas about not just within their immediate ecosystem, but kind of broadly within their partners and then the community.
Yeah, I agree with that, especially when it comes to even building data centers using green construction materials, for example. That's something on Ecotech Insights. I've been interviewing a lot of people looking to do that from top to bottom, make it a sustainable effort.
You know, an interesting thing, Mitchell and I have a friend, Terry Swack, and she's the CEO, founder of a company. Is it Clean Minds, Green Minds?
Sustainable Minds.
Sustainable Minds. It's actually Terry's birthday. Happy birthday, Terry.
It is. Happy birthday, Terry.
But you know, I was with Terry a couple months ago. We had a few drinks. But she gave me an interesting fact. 25% or more of greenhouse gases are tied into building. Mm-hmm. Whether it's the manufacturer of materials that we build with, or in the act of building itself, of construction, tremendous amounts. Data centers are at, you know, kind of at the top of that list, right? That's why they, you know, for a while we were building data centers in the Arctic, because you can get cool it there, or they build a data center next to a hydroelectric dam to get access to it. AI is exacerbating this, but here's the golden lining for me. let's use AI to figure out how to build better, more sustainable facilities for AI. I think this is a case where, you know, you can have your cake and eat it too, to your point.
Well, that's I'm sorry, go ahead.
Okay.
Go ahead.
I think this is a watershed moment. Comes the day that Microsoft spends this amount of time and energy to create a blog that looks like a position paper, it means that people are screaming in their ears about this and that they're hearing that this is a serious issue. And they're basically running a PR game here to say, you know, we're doing something about this while we continue to consume massive amounts of energy. So I kind of feel like, yes, it's great that we're talking about it, but I've, you know, been around this block with these guys a few dozen times and I know how they operate. And when they start writing at this level, it means that, you know, they're trying to lobby somebody and they're trying to prevent some legislation from being crafted or something's up. So I think there's more here than what it looks like.
You know, if AI is the engine, data is the fuel. That's the other half to the coin you're talking about,
yeah. Alan,
which is, think about the vast amounts of data, and Terry's company is one example who has a lot of data about the impact of the manufacturing materials and all of that. Think about all the data that we have now about products that we're creating, and now that we're paying attention to it, gathering the right kind of data to be able to make the best decisions about reducing impact, about operating it more efficiently or building it more effectively, or reusing all those the byproducts of those activities. So it's AI, but AI powered by a lot of really great valuable data.
And, you know, one of the things with AI when it comes to fighting climate change is we're seeing a surge of companies that are creating twofold. One, measuring carbon emissions within software and different companies. But the other side is what Alan was talking about, the innovation and technology to reduce emissions, build more sustainably, track different areas where we're not monitoring emissions, like let's say through drones. I interviewed someone from a company that does that. So I think that the Microsoft blog does point to a bigger picture of like what Mike was saying, of what we're what they're looking for going forward. But underneath it all are these innovations that are happening around the world right now to track, monitor carbon solutions, and also create solutions just to mitigate the if we're going to use this much AI, we know we are. Okay, well then how are we going to manage not tapping into water, which is limited already? So I think it's all happening at the same time.
Can I ask you a question? Do you think Microsoft's blog post is something that will be like to the watershed moment? Others will use as a pattern or a baseline to start doing now. Let's us put our position paper kind of validating or extending with that. Is it that big of an impact?
It depends on who's looking towards Microsoft 100% for leadership. But across the board, if you go to different websites of different companies, it is prominently displayed now, and something that I find that people want to push forward more in their messaging of how they're doing their own ESG goals and their sustainability. But a leader like Microsoft definitely could set off a chain reaction.
Validates it.
I think there's a guy somewhere, a gal in Europe working for the EU, has their pencil out and is calculating right now what the carbon AI tax is going to be for the impact that these things are having on the environment, and what they're going to come back to folks and say, hey, This is a real cost that you're going to have to bear. And I think that, you know, a lot of this stuff is pre-positioning to kind of get in front of that stuff.
It's possible.
Shades of Al Gore.
Who reinvented the internet,
yes.
Right?
All right. Anything else on sustainable AI?
Well, we'll see what the ripple effect of this is and what the outcomes might be. Right?
And I just think it's something, a topic to keep your eye on, because it's going to just keep coming up more and more.
Vote for more efficient LLMs. That would be the way to go, is just to reduce the amount of carbon being generated in the first place.
We're going to talk about LLMs next, but first, here's a break. You're watching Tech Strong, gang.
SecurityBoulevard.com is the leading resource for news, analysis, and education on challenges facing the cybersecurity industry. SecurityBoulevard.com covers all aspects of cybersecurity, including data security, DevSecOps, cloud security, application security, network security, security threats, and more. SecurityBoulevard.com has the largest selection of security content, featuring breaking news, blog posts, podcasts, and more. Visit www.securityboulevard.com to learn more. SecurityBoulevard.com, home of Security Bloggers Network.
All right, folks, we're back, and as promised, we're talking about LLMs. Tab 9 has basically put out an announcement saying you can bring your own LLM to their tool that lets you write code or test code that will be automatically generated by their LLM. But now they're turning around and saying, hey, you know what? You can bring OpenAI or whatever LLM you feel like. And it seems like to me, we just went from, wow, this is the most amazing innovation in the world, to maybe an expensive commodity that I can just call through an API and I'll swap them out as I see fit.
It's internet time, baby.
Well, it's interesting because Tab 9 went through their own transition because they had their own proprietary non-LLM, Gen AI-based product, and they transitioned to Gen AI. Now they're transitioning to, and you can add your own. Because a lot of the concern is just about, I don't want to code. I don't want to put my code into a third-party LLM that I'm going to lose the data. I lose control over that. I mean, even, you know, I hear people talking about podcasts of use LM Studio to just do your own LLM. Take it from Hugging Face and work on it in your own environment. So it seems like that almost, you know, kind of the hoteling of your own LLM and tools will be a trend to be able to protect it.
I'm trying to figure out if people are going to orchestrate LLMs across different tasks. So I'll have an LLM that's optimized for a specific function, and then I'll use another LLM for a different thing, and then I'll have these agents stitched together, and has that become a workflow? I think it's early yet, but it feels like that's where it's going.
That's kind of what the Oracle announcement was about, right? Yeah, they announced I called a broker to decide which LLM or Gen AI system will answer what part of the prompt.
Look, I think we're moving to a modular future. We saw this when we were at reInvent, guys, right? When we were doing our interviews. The way of the future is sort of, what's the sales one called, Einstein?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Where it's a front end and it can plug in multiple LLMs, it can plug into multiple AIs. You're not in a walled garden. Choice will be the rule of the day until one of these becomes dominant or something like that. But I think the market has already spoken fairly quickly and early that they want choice when it comes to LLMs, and they want choice when it comes to which AI. They don't want to be locked into OpenAI or Google's or anyone's for that matter.
They also want specialized or domain-specific LLMs. They want small SLMs, right? Mm-hmm. To be up to the efficiency point, right? Instead of throwing, you know, OpenAI, Gen AI at it, ChatGPT, let's do something that just does code for these kind of environments.
I agree. I think it does sound like it's a more efficient option. But is it more taxing on energy overall if you're using, if the LMs are getting larger themselves? That's more of a question, I guess.
To the other point you were talking about using AI, I think you'll be monitoring like, well, I can run six of them, but these two do the most efficient. I can save a lot of money just by sending more as long as I'm getting the data from it. I think that'll be one of the factors of who wins.
Yeah, and there's a subtle difference between the training of the LLM requires massive amounts of data and energy. The inference engine that creates, and it's only like in terabytes, and you can kind of drop that at the edge, not so much energy being consumed on the inference engine side of the equation. But we saw OpenAI and Microsoft were talking about building a $100 billion data center somewhere to drive some massive LLM. And you gotta wonder, do we really need a general purpose LLM to that size to do what for us? Because it seems like the smaller LLMs are more efficient.
Maybe it'll be a bunch of small ones and they're just calling it one thing, you know, who knows?
You know, I think that's going to be an interesting evolution we need to watch on that. I as an industry, we always tend to go big or go home, right? So let's build the super duper computer LLM. But I think the fact of the matter is early, at least, and it's still early, so who the heck knows. But the early indications are that smaller, more focused give you better results than trying to boil the ocean.
Think about it. Do you want ChatGPT to organize your calendar and prioritize things? Do you want an SLM that's really specialized at time management, calendar, whatever?
I think that, you know, but it'll be interesting how it plays out. But I look, LLMs are going to be commodities, how quickly they're commodities.
They already are. Hugging Face is proving that, right?
I mean, and that's just the way of this.
And I think it becomes easier to swap because I may just be invoking the LLM output through an API. And if that's the case, then, you know, I'll just move between cloud service providers as I need, and then I'll just take the inference engine and deploy that wherever I need. And everything becomes disposable, swappable.
Maybe you put the prompt to four LLMs and three of them agree that's the right answer. You know, you arbitrage
immutable.
Things. Immutable. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Excellent.
Interesting times.
Yes, it is. I mean, you always live in interesting times. We're ending this on an Irish.
I thought that was a Chinese proverb.
A Chinese proverb. Okay. Okay. No, I thought it was an Irish.
We're already getting yelled at by the Chinese for today.
All right. Let's keep the Irish out of it. Anyway, that's going to wrap it for Tech Strong Gang today. Many thanks to Daniel Newman from Futurum for joining us on the Intel piece. Thank you, Bonnie, Mitchell, Mike. We will be back on Monday, so not Friday. We'll do a best of. We'll be back on Monday with fresh Tech Strong Gang. Enjoy the rest of Tech Strong TV today. We're out.
Hey, guys. This is JJ Manila with Mitch Ashley, co-host of CISO Talk, where we have engaging bite-sized conversations for current and next-gen CISOs.
You know, we have some of the best conversations on CISO Talk with some of the greatest talent in security. People like Andy Ellis, who talked to us about optimizing security strategies and how to navigate the boardroom. Lisa Bradley came on and talked about vulnerability management, bug bounty programs, and why SBOMs aren't the solution to all your software security problems. Steve Reynolds was also another great guest, and he talked to us about what not to do when a security incident happens.
The what not to do's are great, but we also had Eve Mailer and Steve Bitten on talking about security and third-party software, SaaS applications, and weaponizing AI. So go ahead and join us for the latest episode of CISO Talk. You can find us by going to techstrong.tv/CISO Talk.